This is Thursday, July 18, 1968, part of the summer session at Pendle Hill. This will be Howard Brinton.
Ought to hold on, or have held on, to something that is not really fundamental at all.
Well, this word system is a rather slippery and unfortunate word. It's very often used by writers on the subject of religion to designate what might be called an ecstatic union with absolute being, a vision of the ultimate reality, the capital R, above all change and relativity and finiteness, even good and evil. We're in a world of shadows and partial reality, but beyond us and around us and in us, there is this world of pure being, which can't be described because it's infinite and cannot be accordingly expressed in any finite terms. That is often designated as mysticism. There's a recent book come out by Professor Stace of Princeton, which entitled The Philosophy of Mysticism, which is confined very largely to that kind of an experience. He finds it to be almost the same in all parts of the world, among Buddhists and Hindus and Arab Sufis and Christian mystics, who describe or attempt to describe. Of course, they say over and over again that they can't speak about it because it's beyond speech. In spite of the fact that they say they cannot say anything about it, they sometimes say a great deal. I once came to a temple in Japan where three old monks were printing a book of 60,000 woodblocks, each one containing four pages of the book. So here was a book of 480,000 pages, all devoted to saying that you couldn't say anything about it. Well, I suppose your concern is not with that particular type of experience, although there has been a great deal written about it, very often in terms of the stages. For instance, the Hindu yogi usually has eight stages. The first two are purely moral behavior, ending in what he calls samadhi, the state of absolute union with Brahman, the ultimate reality beyond all appearance. Other mystics have written of stages like St. Teresa and St. John of the Cross and Eckhart and so on, and also the Buddhists who seek for a similar experience in Nirvana or Satori, as it's called in Japan, a vision of what is infinite and formless, but yet is not contaminated by any trace of finiteness or relativity. But the result of that experience is pure infinite awareness, chit, infinite being, sit, or infinite bliss, ananda, using the Hindu expressions. And so it is considered to be the supreme end of life to attain this tremendous experience of absolute being. Well, I suppose your concern is not so much with this, and you don't find very much of it in Quakerism, or nearly so much of it in the West as in the East. I wouldn't say that this experience of the absolute one, capital O, is without ethical results. I think it does have practical results because it is an experience of complete unity with all life, with a being which is in every person and of which you are a part or a fragment. And so the person who has this experience does, according to reports, have a much stronger sense of his unity with all life. And in Hinduism and Buddhism, that would include animal life as well as human life. And having experienced that sense of unity with other beings, then you are likely to be more unselfish, because in helping other beings, you're really helping your higher self, yourself with a capital S. That other person is yourself. Every other person that lives is yourself. And so in helping them, having a sympathetic sense of unity with them, you are more likely to be compassionate in your behavior and to be unselfish in your behavior because of your sense of unity. That is, if you enter a building that's on fire at some sacrifice to yourself, you don't do it for any selfish motive. You do it because you have a sense of unity with the people in that house. Or if you help a shipwrecked crew, save a shipwrecked crew from drowning, it's not for any selfish reason, as far as your own particular individual self is concerned. It's because you feel a sense of unity and compassionate unity with the people who are in need of help. And if you perform a thoroughly unselfish act, then that is a sign that you have a sense of unity with the absolute being who unites all things in himself. That experience of union with the absolute is not the final stage in the ladder. The last stage in the ladder is a descent from the transcendent stage to association with your fellow human beings. For instance, the stage where you come into unity with the absolute in Zen Buddhism is the 10th stage, the 8th, 10th stage is one of coming back into the village and seeing the Buddha nature in every human being, as it is in yourself. And with St. Teresa, who has, I think, 7 stages, the final stage, I think the 8th stage is an ecstasy, but the final stage is spiritual marriage, where you can live on both levels at once, the human level of relativity and the absolute level of relativity. And in this, what she calls the spiritual marriage, you are both in communion with the infinite and the finite, and the two interact with each other. So the final stage, even in the cases of these efforts toward an ecstatic union with the absolute, the final stage is often a practical one of helpfulness towards other persons. Well, that kind of experience is not deliberately sought for very much in Western, in the Judeo-Christian religion, as it's often called. I think it's very largely because the Judeo-Christian religion has 2 ancestors. One is Greek and the other is Hebrew. The Hebrew influence is prophetic and activist. The Hebrew prophets always had some particular concern in mind, some particular thing that their audience should do and were not doing. They were very specific in their directions as to what should be done. But the Greek mystics did believe in that kind of ecstatic union with the absolute being. Following Plato, where we live in a shadow world, but the absolute is not beyond our experience, but can be experienced. And a mystic like Plotinus or Eckhart or many others are very largely under Platonic influence in seeking primarily a union with the absolute Godhead, who is beyond God, or with absolute one, who is beyond all the many. So since Christianity has both a Greek ancestor and a Hebrew ancestor, it is partly a mixture of Greek mysticism and Hebrew prophetism, one being primarily ethical and the other being more mystical and philosophic. Now, I was surprised increasingly when Marion Glazer was reading to me the letters of George Fox. I was surprised to find how much of the Greek type of mysticism was in Fox. I had thought of him as very similar to a Hebrew prophet. He certainly was in the way he talked when he said, "This is the word of the Lord to you," when he wrote to other Quakers. He was speaking for the Lord. He was the mouthpiece of the Lord in writing these letters. But there is also in Fox a great deal of the Greek philosophy, which holds that there is a divine spirit in all things, which exerts a unifying, integrating power on the world of sense, which brings things together and brings things into order, promotes a cosmos out of a chaos. And so God creates not out of nothing, but by bringing order into chaos, bringing things into a form which were formerly formless, and so on. But I don't find a great deal of that sort of thing in the Quaker journalists. My knowledge, what direct knowledge I have of early Quakerism, comes more from the journalists than from anybody that writes about Quakerism. When you write about Quakerism, as I've attempted to do, you get it third hand. But I think with the journalist who's writing an autobiography, you get it second hand at least. You get his or her account of their own religious experiences. And those religious experiences are more of the Hebraic prophetic type than they are of the Greek mystical type, because this journalist always records when they were first called to the ministry. All of these journals were written by Quaker ministers, not professional ministers, persons who were farmers or storekeepers or housewives who had a call to travel in the ministry. I once calculated the average age of the journalist who had a call, found to be about 26. Some of them didn't get a call till their 40s or 50s. Some were called while in their teens. Most of the early Quakers were in their teens. It was a young people's movement, essentially. George Fox was 23 when he started out in his travels.